KPCW News Time now, 8:15. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Joining me now in the studio, I have the Park City School District Business Administrator joining us on the phone. We hope to have Park City School Board member Petra Butler. But we'll start with you, Todd. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let me see. Nick Solomon was before the board from the Collaborative Learning Network presenting a master planning presentation, very thorough, covering the elements that the district would need to proceed with a bond and talk through several scenarios, the first being to try for a bond in the fall of 2018, the second in the fall of 2019, and finally in the fall of 2020. Petra Butler said that she didn't want to proceed with master planning with the sole focus of how it's the fastest way to get a bond passed. J.J. Ehlers said that she was happy about a demographic study that's underway. It's something that's never been done in the school district and basically considered instrumental in the master planning process to decide where and what additional facilities will be needed in the future. Solomon suggested that there may be ways to mitigate the problems in Treasure Mountain Junior High School by splitting the school in two and creating an eighth grade wing separate to a ninth grade wing. So let's just talk a little bit about what all of this demographic study means. It's supposed to be finished by the end of the year. What happens next after that?
So with the demographic study, we will have some geocoding and some mapping of where the student population resides right now who are attending the schools. And we've also asked them to look out 5 years and 10 years to see how that population might shift so that we are looking at where schools should be located and what sizes the schools would need to be to house all those students.
Yeah. Our sense, based on this year, we saw growth decline.
We did. We did. And so that will be either confirmed through this demographic process or refined as to what that might look like. But we're really looking at what will be in the next 5 to 10 years. What do we anticipate growth to be? Where will the housing developments show up? How will the population change in that time period? Because that's really the time horizon that we're trying to build the buildings for long term.
Yeah. Is there any discussion at this point? And I've heard from people living in the Wasatch School District and the South Summit School District specifically, just saying we're seeing so much growth concentrated just outside of Park City's boundaries. Is there any talk at this point about some kind of school district consolidation or redrawing of district boundaries?
Sure. So conversations have ebbed and flowed, at least for the 5 years that I've been up here in the school district. So I'm sure those conversations will ebb and flow as we continue to find out what are the best solutions for serving the students right on our borders. With Wasatch, it's a transportation challenge. They're so far away from where the schools are. They can see our schools on the way to their schools, and same with some of the South Summit students. So there's motivations to talk at that level. Also, we're looking at the secondary level of seeing if there are ways to collaborate program offerings. So at the high school level or the CTE programs, tech programs, to see if we co-located a facility, could we have students from all the districts participate at that site? In which case, it's not quite the boundaries changing, but a program that would be offered for all of the school districts at a single site.
And I can remember back in the early 90s even talking about a consolidation of all three Summit County school districts. Are those plans off the...
I've not heard anything that way.
Hmm. In terms of if this then mapping and demographic study shows us that the school district population will be static, what does that tell us about expanding the need for facilities?
So that helps us to, well, there's several things. One is how many facilities and how large should the facilities be. The next thing that we also want to have in the master planning process is what should the learning environments look like? As we move forward to the different learning styles and the needs of the students, how should those spaces look? How should they be configured? How should they collaboration spaces be designed and things of that nature? So it's not just how many students, it's what should that environment look like as well. And this demographic study will tell us, okay, you're going to have this many students in this area for a school. How can we couple that with the ideas of how we want that learning environment to appear?
Right. So are we in the rush that we were in a couple of years ago to get a bond approved?
I think there are still some pressures. to look at our facilities as they stand now. We have a fair amount of programming that is happening at different levels at different schools. We'd like to bring that all up on a level playing field or an equal basis. And not all the schools are built the same. They're not all the same capacity. They're not all the same configurations. And to be able to bring those programs into play is a challenge. So we do have some physical constraints that aren't just driven by student population.
And we were in such a rush to tear down Treasure Mountain Junior High School. We've put enough money into it at this point that it's worth keeping for a while?
So at this point, we're pulling it along. I don't know that we've put huge investments into it to make it last another 10, 15 years. What we're making it is appropriate for the students that are in it right now. So maintaining the systems that are in the building, making sure that the spaces are clean and appropriate for the students.
Yeah, you also gave an update on the capital projects budget yesterday. Most of the projects are complete for the year, with the final numbers looking like they came in under budget.
The majority of the projects are coming in under budget, and that's always a good sign.
Yeah. The safety updates have been mostly completed in all of the elementary schools?
So there's different projects within the safety plan. The vestibules, or those front entranceway for the elementary schools, are nearing completion. They won't be completed actually until after break. So those are the most advanced in that process. We also are looking at keying systems and locking mechanisms and visitor management systems. We've concluded all of those RFPs, so we're in the process of making selections for those vendors. We also have an RFP that's out for a safety consultant, and we'd like to bring them on board before we make final decisions on any of those other systems to make sure we're putting the right systems in place.
Yeah. So why the need for a safety consultant? I mean, I know that one gentleman has pressured the board to do this. Is that widespread?
I think the feel is that we've worked with architects and with mechanical engineers to see how could we put safety measures into the buildings. But we probably need to step back a little bit and just say, are we looking at the right solution for what we're wanting to do? Is this the right way to secure the perimeter of a school? Is this the right way to manage visitors as they come to the schools so that we're not creating a prison environment at one extreme? But we still want to be welcoming and hoping that parents and volunteers will come to the schools and not feel that they're being shaken down on the way through to work with the kids.
Yeah, so what are we paying for a consultant then to...
Good question. We'll find out when those bids all come in.
Okay. When does that happen?
That'll close this Thursday afternoon.
Okay. So everything else remains on hold then until we get the recommendations from the consultant? In terms of the perimeter fencing?
On hold for a week or two, but not permanently. So once we get that safety consultant on board, we'll be able to move forward. If all our plans look good and appropriate for the situations that we're in, we already have done the RFP work, so it's just a matter of awarding contracts. So I think it's just a minor delay.
All right. So in terms of looking at the budget next year, I know that you're trying to push things up a couple of months so that you'll have basically a budget plan in effect, as soon as March?
Correct. Yeah. So we're hoping to have a pretty in-depth conversation with the board regarding the budget in January. And that will really set the baseline for what we need to have in place for the upcoming school year. By March, we want to have that finalized so that we can build the numbers around it and actually have a full proposal for the public to see at a budget hearing that would take place in April.
All right. Well, we know, we've been told, I should say, that a tax increase is imminent, and that would be to pay for the increase in salaries that were awarded for this school year. What are we looking at in terms of an increase?
So we had forecasted about a $3.5 million tax increase last year as we were putting the budget together. And that was for compensation. It was for additional staffing as we looked at the health and safety needs of the school, as well as maintaining fund balance. So that was all contemplated. That property values of last year represented about an $86 increase on a home valued at $650,000. So that's kind of our get-go point. We kind of anticipate that what the rest of the conversation is, what else is needed as we move into the next school year, what other things are needed in the classrooms, what other things are needed based on student population and demographics.
And we're talking about another $3.5 million for that?
Potentially, yeah. We're having those conversations. They're kind of the very entry level, kind of raw numbers, raw ideas, and we need to refine those and get those down to what the actual ask will be that will appear in March.
Yeah. So when we talk about $7 million, based on what you know now, what does that tax increase look like? I mean, can you break it out on $100,000?
It's looking about $189 on a $650,000 valued home.
Okay. In terms of the timeline, again, we hope to have this before the public sometime in April.
Definitely in April. It will most likely come out the end of March, but definitely the first part of April.
All right. In terms of any legislative issues that you're hearing about, anything you can talk about?
So we're watching the tax reform ideas. So the national government has taken care of some tax reforms. We'll see how that trickles down into the state level. A lot of that has to do with income tax, which is the primary funding source for public education. So we'll have to watch how our state legislature responds to the federal tax reform. Equalization will still be out there. The governor's budget that came out a week and a half ago was looking very encouraging for public education, a very sizable increase in the value of the WPU. You know, 70% of the monies, the new monies coming into the state, he's directing into public education. So we're pretty excited about the messaging he's putting out there and the expectations that are coming from his budget.
Okay, so maybe not as big a tax increase as we think.
That would be awesome.
Okay, I'm going to turn the time now to Park City School Board member Petra Butler. You'll need to put headphones on, Todd, if you want to hear the conversation. Petra, you had the board had a presentation from Terry Shoemaker, who works for the Utah State School Boards Association, basically outlining how that organization can help. It basically seemed like he was plugging the district to hire his services. Is that true?
Well, you know what? We wouldn't be hiring their services. Their services would be free to us because we're part of that organization. So it was just a difference between whether we're going to go with a private consultant or that we would be utilizing their services. And I believe the last time that we went through the superintendent search, we used a private consultant, and so we just went that way again.
Okay, so what should we expect to pay to hire a new superintendent?
You know what? I don't know the answer to that. We just recently put out the RFPs. Todd may have a better answer for this, and we haven't had the return yet, so I'm not really sure what the cost associated with that is.
Do you recall what it cost to hire Ember?
So last time we had a combination of work with USBA and a third-party consultant, and those costs were probably in the $20,000 to $25,000 range, mostly for the brochure that went out in conjunction with the advertisement. The services were not as at that level.
All right. Well, Petra, one of the elements that Shoemaker talked about in his presentation is how important it is to be a cohesive board and that it's essential to have clear roles defined. Specifically, he talked about redefining the roles of the school board and the role of the superintendent. So does the Park City School Board overstep its role by involving itself in the administration of the policies and kind of dictating how the district is being managed?
No, I would just completely disagree with that statement, Leslie. I think there is a level of accountability that this board wants to hold the administration and the superintendent to. I don't think it's any different than any other previous board. I just think it's a little more recognizable because we're asking a lot more questions that were probably asked in the past. But I think we are a very cohesive team. I think we're working very well to get through all the issues, specifically the policies that we're dealing with. And so I think it's a really good process that we've developed, and I think we're working well together.
Yeah, board member Ehlers asked if having six superintendents in the last 24 years is an indication that the district may have a problem retaining its superintendents. Shoemaker basically said yes in a very diplomatic and professional way. Do you think it's a problem?
I do, and the irony is I've had the opportunity to talk to several superintendents in Utah, and unfortunately Park City does have a reputation for keeping superintendents for a short period of time. And one of the reasons that I've heard overall is because we have a very demanding community. And so I think that's something that that our community needs to be aware of. I think perhaps we need to start looking at different expectations from within our community. And it's something that the new superintendent that we bring in needs to be well aware of.
So what's the board willing to do to take on this reputation?
Yeah, you know, Leslie, that is a very good question. It is something that the board has now started discussions about what the expectations will be, not only of our parents, but of our stakeholders and everybody else in the community, and what can we do to address that issue.
One person gave public input yesterday asking the school board to do what's needed to convince Amber Conley to reconsider her resignation. What do you think about that request?
You know, I think it's a very fair request. I think the community needs to be well aware that she's done a great job while she's been here. She's been our superintendent for 5 years. She's been here longer than any other superintendent that I'm aware of. And, you know, it was her decision to resign, and I think we need to be respectful of that. And if there's any questions about whether she wants to retain that position, I have yet to hear that as a board member. If that is something that Dr. Conley is interested in, then I think she needs to approach the board with that.
Yeah. Would you prefer that she stay on? Or do you feel like you were elected to see that she goes?
No, I wouldn't say I was elected to see that she goes. I think she's done a great job. I think, you know, what we were just talking about, the demanding parents in our community, you know, the role that she's been asked to play, I think it's been tough. I think it's been very difficult. We've had community members come to comment and say things that she believed were hurtful to her. And so I can understand. I mean, there's a certain level where you just burn out. And I think she may have reached that level. And so if she's interested in remaining, I think that's something that she needs to approach the board about.
So we don't really know how much it's going to cost. But how long do we anticipate it taking to replace Amber? I mean, she's on until next June. So what's the timeline here? To have somebody step in her role, maybe June 1?
You know, that's a good question. It's something the board has been talking about. We're fortunate enough that she chose to resign at the time that she did so that we have the opportunity to begin the search in January rather than having to wait till April or May. So we're in a good spot that we're going to have probably first choice of a lot of superintendents that might be looking for other employment. I just want to reiterate the fact that, you know, when Todd talked about that brochure and it costing $20,000 to $25,000, USBA would not provide for a brochure as well. So those are costs that we would have encumbered anyway. So when we're talking about looking at utilizing USBA services or using outside services, we'd have to pay for some services either way.
And who's going to be on this search and selection committee?
It will be, you know, I think it will follow very much what we did last time. It will include community members, stakeholders, teachers, administrators. We'd like as many people involved in the process as possible.
Real quick, wanted to talk a little bit about the safety drill that was done last week. Successful, according to the superintendent. Some of the discoveries were reviewed by Melinda Colton yesterday. She said they found some efficiencies in the way that the texting system is used and the way texts are written. For instance, using punctuation in the text slowed the transmission substantially. And then it's like, if you don't use it, oh my gosh, right? You'll hear about it.
Exactly. Yes, you know what, and those are things that we would have never known had we not tried. So, you know, kudos to the efforts that are being done to make this process more efficient. And to learn something as simple as a hyphen makes such a big difference, it's really good to know.
All right, and in terms of the master planning, you've got this Collaborative Learning Network presenting a presentation yesterday, and you basically saying you do not want to proceed with master planning with the sole focus of getting a bond pass. So what is the sole focus?
Well,
or
the
number
focus
one focus?
Sure, the number one focus is to make sure that we do this master planning process correctly and in a timely manner. And when I say a timely manner, I just don't want to say, okay, we have to have this done by July so that we can really move forward with pushing a bond through. You know, I want to make sure, one of the criticisms I've heard in the past is that, oh, we rush things. So I want to make sure that we take the time to do this right. And if it doesn't work with a bond this fall, then folks will have to look at bonding the following fall if bonding is necessary at all. We talked about how enrollment is decreasing. I mean, so these are all factors that we need to take into account. And I want to make sure that we're doing this logically and with data that supports the decisions that we'll be making and not with the sole focus being the bond.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
You know, I'm really excited about the informal exchanges that the board has been doing. We had one. We had 14 people show up. The next one is going to be at McPolin on January 10th from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. This is an opportunity for the community to come and address board members in a very informal setting, and I invite the community to come.
Okay, Petra and Tom, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, the Park City Council meets Thursday, starting in work session at 3:45. At 4 o'clock, a joint discussion with the Planning Commission to discuss the Sweeney Properties Master Plan. In the studio, Park City Manager Diane Foster, along with Assistant City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So the Planning Commission has a special work session tonight with an agenda that says the applicant and planning staff will present preliminary site suitability, height, and access considerations for project alternatives. That's the same language on the City Council meeting. What does it mean? Matt, you want to take that?
Sure. Thank you. So the purpose of the work session tonight and tomorrow night with City Council is really to provide the public and the Planning Commission and City Council members with an early input opportunity. And what that means is, you know, potentially if this alternative were to work out, we would have a new applicant. And the new applicant would be PC2, otherwise known as Elizabeth Rad. And so what we wanted to do is start off in a place where any critical flaws, any particular information from Planning Commission and the City Councilors could be dealt with up front. And so the applicant would then have about 2 to 2.5 weeks to quickly work over the holidays when everyone goes and spend time with their family before coming back with some actual alternatives and some schematics.
Yeah. So you say the applicant would be Park City 2 LLC. At what point does the city become the applicant? Because it's like you're the one driving the project here, no?
No, I would say that I don't see us as ever being the applicant, but I do see us as responsible for trying to achieve a best possible outcome for the community. So we are going to expend any and all resources we can as a staff and as an organization to make sure that we minimize the impacts to the neighborhoods, to deal with some of the excavation issues and soils issues that we've been hearing about for the past 18 months. And so the planning commissioners are going to be particularly important. And so this is an early input opportunity for them to meet directly with potentially the new future applicant and get some of their initial opinions across the board.
So as you mentioned, it's taken us 18 months to get to a place where we thought we could take a vote on the current proposal before these negotiations kind of change things up. Some members of the Planning Commission didn't think they had even received enough information to take a vote, but was committed to doing so by the end of the year. So what makes you think you can come up with the parameters of a project in the next 3 weeks?
Well, it will absolutely be a daunting task. It's going to take a lot of work, but I think we're very fortunate that we've had almost 2 years leading up to this point, and I would say that that's what makes it possible. If we hadn't spent the last 18 months digesting all of the various inputs and variables up there, we wouldn't be in this position to kind of quickly get together with some technical professionals, use the concerns that the community and the planning commissioners have raised, and put together a package that's palatable to the public, that's palatable to the planning commissioners, and is palatable to city council members. So in my thinking, without the work of the last 18 months, we wouldn't have been in this position, and I don't believe it would have been possible.
Still, I mean, what we're hearing is that all of the impacts, none of the impacts change. All of the impacts remain, just a shorter time period.
Well,
I guess... less cement trucks, less... Right, all
right.
Of
and,
that.
And we'll actually, that's a very good question, and I've heard that as well throughout the community. I was, you know, dropped my daughter off at school today, and I heard something similar. But that's what we're going to find out, and I think that's what the planning commissioners will be able to determine as they review perhaps an amended development agreement, which I think it might make sense just for the benefit of the public, if you don't mind, to just kind of go through the deal points again real quickly, which is to reduce the scale of the project by 50%, to shift some of the intensity towards single family. And by doing that, we believe we might get in a place where the alternative is better for the neighborhood, it's better for Old Town, and it's better for the community. But ultimately, those decisions will be made by the Planning Commission and then ultimately the public. And so that's where we think that decision should be made. I think I said last week that this decision was too large, the magnitude was too great to make inside City Hall.
So what needs to happen before we decide that we move forward with this or not?
Well, two things, and they'll happen sort of in parallel. Ultimately, we'd have to get to a place where the planning commissioners had a positive recommendation, and the city council members had a positive recommendation. And that would be in the form of an amended development agreement, which is under the planning commission's authority, and under the terms of a settlement agreement, which would be under the authority of the city council. And the settlement agreement would be to buy half the density down, As we said, with a $6 million down payment and a $24 million voter-approved general obligation bond. And then the amended development agreement would confine the development into maybe where the 100,000 square foot boutique hotel would go, where the 18 single-family, kind of reducing the intensity from commercial towards single-family, would be located, where some of the roads might go, the ingress, egress, the soils, excavation, traffic impacts. And so twofold, two parallel processes. One is a settlement agreement with City Council, and the other would be a development, an amended development agreement with the Planning Commission.
Yeah. So what's the deadline on getting that all that done?
Great question. The deadline is the end of January, and so for the benefit of the public, we've got two meetings tonight and tomorrow night where we have this kind of initial input opportunity. And then we're going to take about 2 weeks off over the holidays and allow the applicant to work with staff and their technical professionals. And they'll be working feverishly to come back with some alternatives for the planning commissioners. So the really, really important date or deadline that I think I would want to leave with the public is January 4th. That's going to be the first meeting that I think the public can walk into the room and actually see some mass, form, scale, not design, not necessarily what it's going to look like, but where it might be located, where the roads might, where you might enter the property from. And so that's going to be the first opportunity, I think, for the public to really see the output of what's scaling back the density by 50% and shifting density to single family. They'll really be able to see the change from what they've been seeing.
So the negotiations, as we had heard, had been going on for months. So has some of this planning work been done?
You know, that's a good question. We've gotten I've gotten that question a lot around town, too. And I guess the answer is no, to be perfectly honest. The negotiations really happened through a relationship that the mayor was able to create with the owners of the property. In terms of design and everything else, if this were to succeed, we would have a new applicant coming in with a complete redesign, and the Sweeneys would no longer be involved moving forward. And so this isn't something that was sort of contrived by, as I've heard, sort of the lawyers in the back room or even elected officials or staff. It's actually the opposite. And so everything that we're going to do from now on is really going to be in the public domain. There was obviously a little bit that had to be done behind closed doors and in a closed session, because when you're dealing with terms of a potential settlement agreement and property rights, that's a very sensitive subject. However, I think we're at the stage now, which is really phase two, whereas if this is going to work, it needs to be very, very transparent, and the public needs to be involved, it needs to be heard, it needs to be able to weigh in. And so, no, actually, this wasn't something that's been kind of baked and predetermined, and that's why you're seeing this process unfold over 4 or 5 weeks, as opposed to just us showing up with this plan that's already loaded and already fully baked. So that's a good question, but no, it's actually not.
Okay. And again, tonight and tomorrow night, public input will be accepted. We really don't have anything in front of us to comment on, though.
Well, you may. I mean, there are going to be some planning commissioners that are obviously very, very educated about this site, about the topography, about the previous design. And so I think there will be some robust discussion about preferences, about their kind of technical input about how to better mitigate some of the factors that they were really hung up on. And so I think that the public will benefit from that discussion, and then will also be able to weigh in and have their concerns heard. So as an example, the applicant just met with some of the representatives from Think yesterday. And so tonight they're going before the Planning Commission, and then the following evening they'll be going before City Council. And then they're going to have 2 weeks to take that home and use all of that input, come back to everyone on the January 4th with maybe some alternatives. I'm not sure if it's going to be two alternatives or three alternatives. And those could include elevations about where they might locate the hotel. They might have a single family pod of four homes and another one of six, or the Planning Commission could have a different construct that they recommend that they look at. So I do think, though, that there is a lot of value in the public paying attention this evening and then the following evening, but particularly on January 4th.
Okay, Diane, real quick, under new business, the council will take more public input on elevating social equity from a top priority to a critical priority. My understanding was that the council decided to wait until next year to decide whether to make that decision. Is that still the case?
That is still the case. They very much, though, want to hear from the public, and that can happen in private or at a public meeting about where this will go. And depending on how many people we have for applicants for city council, the vacant seat, and what's happening in January with treasurer, we may even have time to do a special meeting on social equity.
Someone had commented that the likelihood of someone coming out and saying they're against this isn't likely to happen. Is the city doing anything to provide an anonymous way for those comments to be made?
Sure. Great question. It is happening on the city is putting up a page where people can comment. And importantly, city council members have been approached. You know, if we bring this into the realm of the public and we talk about it in public, people have been willing and actually have talked to city council about the reason they don't support it. So city council does want to hear from everybody about it, and they'll be weighing that question during the retreat.
What's that page that people could give input? And I guess anything on the web is never anonymous, but...
Sure. I'll get back to you with that. Linda Jager and Jed Briggs are working on that, and I'm not actually sure if the page is up yet, but we'll get back to you with that URL.
And then in terms of making this a critical priority, what does that mean? I mean, more money towards it, more time?
It means all of those things, and typically it's at its basic resource discussion. So in the budget process, we budget for outcomes, and when there's a staff committee that reviews all of those, and priorities get higher points than other things. And one example is when council made housing a critical priority, the budget team recommended $40 million for that. So I'm not suggesting we would come back with $40 million for social equity. We would, however, increase the resources. That being said, city council has just made this a top priority, so you will see this increase in its priority in the next year's budget and in the cities in the efforts that we're making. So that will happen even if it doesn't become a critical priority.
Okay. Diane, Matt, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Well, with 2017 coming to a close, we invited Summit County Sheriff Justin Martinez to come in, take a look back at the year. He joins me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So I scan those sheriff reports that come out every few days. I'd say the two biggest issues that I see are theft and domestic violence. What's your sense of what's going on in Summit County in terms of crime?
You know, that's basically the top two that we have is theft and domestic violence. And unfortunately, the domestic violence, you know, we have it everywhere. I sit on the Summit County Domestic Violence Coalition, Peace House. I'm a board member there. And, you know, I'd love to do, if I could do anything as sheriff, is eradicate domestic violence. It ruins families. It's passed on to children. Anything we can do to stop it. But, you know, we do have our fair share of domestic violence here in Summit County, unfortunately.
Yeah. And then thefts, too, mostly just auto burglaries, right?
In auto burglaries, I think, you know, are especially in particular the Jeremy Ranch and Pine Brook area, I think it's really accessible for people coming up from the valley just to drop up over the hill, take the first one or two exits, get up into the neighborhoods. And unfortunately, because we do live in a fairly safe community, I do believe some people from time to time get complacent, leave items in their vehicle, leave doors unlocked, leave windows rolled down. And when they do that, they unfortunately become targets, easy targets.
Yeah. So you say the Jeremy Ranch, Pine Brook, just because easy on and off.
Access. Yeah. They mm-hmm. can jump into the neighborhood, run through a few streets, see what cars are open, what items might be in plain view, and do, you know, if they have to, a smash and grab, jump on the freeway and they're gone.
Yeah. Are you seeing an increase now, especially with people having a lot of stuff in their cars, doing the holiday shopping and such?
You know, we haven't as of yet, but it's very traditional that during this time of season, we do see a spike just because people are out and about shopping and they are leaving their packages, their gifts in plain view as they go into another store. And they may forget to lock a door and they're having items that are stolen. So we do see a spike during this time of year, but as of right now, it's maintained.
Yeah. Do you think the theft burglary problem has anything to do with the drug problem? I mean, is it a way?
There's a correlation. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There's a correlation between narcotics use and theft. They've got to feed that habit. And so if they steal a cell phone, they steal a computer, they steal an iPad, or if they just get in and somebody has change in their cigarette tray or in a cup holder, they'll grab whatever they can. Generally speaking, to feed that addiction.
Yeah. How has the year been for the Sheriff's Department dealing with drug issues, especially maybe overdoses? I know you guys saved somebody.
We have. We just had our Christmas party, and part of our Christmas party, we give out awards. And I was fortunate enough to give out 6 life-saving medals this year for people that were overdosing on some sort of opiate and we were able to administer the Narcan to bring them out of it. And so in a couple of them, they were in the middle of performing CPR. One of them was at Whole Foods, and as the call came in, the caller stated, he's obviously deceased, gray, ashen. But when we get on scene and we hit him with that Narcan, it brings him back. So we were able to actually save 6 lives this year because of having that medication available to deputies on the streets to administer it immediately.
In terms of other problems you see during the holiday season, what, shoplifting, DUIs?
Sure. Yeah, you know, the interesting thing about DUIs, Leslie, is there always will be there, but there's been such a strong, in my opinion, and I think there's some empirical data to support it as well, but there's been such a strong advertisement in media about don't drink and drive. We make it very accessible to get Uber. There's a lot of free cabs on New Year's in particular is what I'm talking about. And during this time of season that I think people are waking up and they're hearing the stories of people that have crashed and killed and they don't want to be a statistic. And so it's just easier to get an Uber. It's easier to call a friend. It's easier to get a taxi cab these days. So I don't see as much DUI, but it's still there. I'm not saying it's disappeared completely, but I believe that the trend is starting to decrease a little bit, which is good news because that means people are paying attention. And like all of us, like me, I guess we grow up from time to time.
Yeah. Anything now that the Sheriff's Department is doing to prepare for the decrease in the blood alcohol content level for prosecuting DUI?
No, not specifically. I mean, we're still waiting to see what the legislature does and what the governor does. The governor's looking at doing a bifurcated law where right now, the way the law is written, if it's a .04, it's just a DUI the way it's currently written. But I would like to see it be more of what Colorado has in place from a .04 to a .08. It's more of a misdemeanor than it is the full DUI. It's more of a alcohol-related driving because .08 has been the standard. It's the standard across the nation. We'd be the only state in the union that had a .04 and the law currently stands. I know that's in the hands of the governor. I know that's in legislation that they're trying to look at ways to make this the law a little bit different, but as of right now, we're not really doing anything specific to train or prepare for the new law.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I just thought, your listeners to don't become victims. Don't make yourself a target. Lock up your packages, put them behind covers, cover them with a blanket if you're going to go into a store, lock your doors. Just do everything you can to not be a victim. And again, use good common sense when it comes to drinking. Go out Christmas, New Year's, have a good time, but call a friend, call a cab, and just wish everybody a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
All right, Justin.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you. Latin Grammy Award winners Lucky Diaz and the Family Jam Band bring in their indie-style songs to the Eccles Center in Park City for 2 shows on December 27th, performing at both 2 and 6 p.m. On the phone with me is the founder of the band, Lucky Diaz. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
I'm well. So you've been described as the Rolling Stones of kids' music. So tell me, what does that mean?
That's quite a statement. I think what we do is try to bring modern indie independent music sounds to children and families. You know, it's a little bit rock and roll, maybe a little bit rebellious if you would consider what traditional children's music is like. So maybe that's why someone had coined that phrase. But that's kind of what we do.
Yeah. So you sing in both English and Spanish. Why do you think that's important?
You know, it's funny. It's incredibly important. I think having, you know, in our new American society and culture, you know, we've always been a melting pot here in the United States, which is one of the most beautiful things about our country. And we have mixed language households, and I think it's really great for, I mean, it's the genesis of this was just in my own household and teaching our own daughters how to speak Spanish and culturally connecting to my half of our cultural engagement. So it's really a lot of fun, and language is fun. You know, I think playing with words has always been, you know, one of the cornerstones of our work. And I can't see any child not responding to that. And I think that's kind of where we go with that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So you and the band have been made popular by the PBS show Lishi Lou and Lucky Too. What was the idea for that program?
You know, we look at our art form, not just as music, but an entire experience, you know, including the visual aspect of that. And I think clearly the show is an extension of the musical work. And so for us, you know, when I was a child growing up watching, you know, Mr. Rogers, Sesame Street, Pee Wee's Playhouse, a lot of these children's shows that were incredible, that are still incredible, it really inspired my musical part of, you know, my creative work. And it just made common sense to just kind of continue in that vein. Alicia, my partner and wife in the band, is a tremendous actor, and that's where her wheelhouse and strengths really are. So we were able to bring it all together, you know?
Yeah. So the song I have queued up to kind of end this interview is Paletero Man. It means ice cream man. This is an important song to you, and because I've read a little bit about why you wrote this song. I mean, everybody loves the ice cream man, right? But maybe you can just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, thanks for asking. I mean, I think we live in a very polarizing time politically and socially. And I thought it was just my way of just trying to bring a little bit of joy and togetherness in the world that we're so constantly, you know, surrounded with so much contention, right? And so for me, I thought, well, everybody loves ice cream. Who doesn't love the ice cream man? And culturally for myself, the paletero always, you know, he really represents the entrepreneurial immigrant really trying to make his way in this world. And for me, I thought, hey, I felt like I can pay homage to my culture and just kind of, you know, subconsciously make a little bit of a political statement in a positive way, because who doesn't love ice cream, really? I mean, you know? And, you know, it brings a smile to everybody's face. And, you know, it was just my way of making some kind of small statement about it, you know.
Well, great. Lucky Diaz again, and the Family Jam Band again will be in Park City on December 27th. Two shows. Tickets are available online at parkcityinstitute.com or by calling the box office at 435-655-3114. Hey, Lucky, thanks for your time this morning. We'll let you you and the band take it out.
Oh, thanks so much for having us, and we're really excited to come and visit, so thank you.